this is the second day of this March 2015 7-day session, and we'll go back to one of our favorite texts. Was also one of Roshi Kaplow's favorite in Teisho, in Sesshin, is Swampland Flowers, the letters and lectures of Zen Master Dawi. He was a 12th century Chinese Zen master from the Sung Dynasty who has been considered kind of Hakuin's counterpart in China. Hakuin, of course, is a Japanese Zen master who was renowned for having revived the koan system that had fallen into ruin somewhat, but not for the first time. Da Wei, some 500 years earlier, was considered the same kind of reviver. Start with some biographical material on Da Wei. He was a disciple of Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu is famous in Koan Zen for having been the author, more or less, of the Blue Cliff Record, collection of koans. Da Wei left home at the age of 17, and received ordination the following year. I'm reading from Zen's Chinese Heritage, edited by Andy Ferguson. As a young man, Da Wei happened to encounter a copy of The Record of Yunmen. These biographies of the early great masters were usually titled The Record of whomever it was. So The Record of Yunmen. Yunmen is the original Chinese name of Umon. His Japanese name is Umon. He felt strangely familiar with the text, as though he had previously studied it. And then later he traveled and trained under various Zen masters. Then he went up to a mountain called Treasure Peak to train under a Zen master named Zhan Tangjun. Zhan recognized Da Wei's unusual ability and assigned him to be his personal attendant. But Da Wei's obstinate personality clashed with his teacher, leading to an exchange in which Zhan ridiculed the young student, saying, "You haven't experienced enlightenment, and the problem is your intellectual understanding." It's unusual, I think, in my reading, it's unusual for a teacher to ridicule or humiliate a student publicly. You have to figure that this Da Wei must have been quite a egoistic person. And Zhan, this is Zen Master Zhan, must have felt that it was must have been somewhat desperate to crack that intellectual armor of Da Wei when he was young, and do what he could. I've heard that some of the Christian mystics would pay people to humiliate them. I don't know, there may be something less healthy about that, but in any case, it can, at the right time with the right person, be just what a very egoistic person needs to crack that armor. Later, Zhan became very ill. He called Da Wei to his side on his deathbed and he advised him to find, to go and find this Yuan Wu, who became Da Wei's main teacher, and apply himself diligently as his student. And now here are the original, the translation of the original words from the Da Wei's record. Soon Da Wei traveled to Yuan Wu's monastery, where he heard the master address the monks. In his talk, Yuan Wu spoke of an incident in which a monk had asked Yunmen, "What is the place where all Buddhas come forth?" And at that, Yunmen had answered, "The water on East Mountain flows uphill." It's quite a challenging question. Place where all Buddhas arise, originate. The water on East Mountain flows uphill. Then someone in the audience asked Yuan Wu, "What is the place where all Buddhas come forth?" Yuan Wu said, "Warm breezes come from the south, but in the palace there's a cold draft." And Da Wei, when he heard these words, his past and future were cut off. That's in quotation marks. That's the original language. Past and future were cut off. Although there was movement, forms were unmanifested. He felt as though sitting in a still, barren place. This would be an experience of emptiness. Not enlightenment, but an experience of emptiness. Yuan Wu continued speaking, "It hasn't been easy, but you've made your way to this great field. What a pity if you were now to die and not be able to attain life. It's a great error to rely on words. Without knowing where you'll fall, just let go of the edge of the cliff. Let yourself do it. After you wake up, you won't be deceived again. You must believe in this." What a pity if you were now to die and not be able to attain life. In other words, to break through the emptiness, go beyond the emptiness. And enter the world of enlightenment. Still, Da Wei was not quite ready yet. And after that, he was selected to be an attendant in the Wood Hall. In this post, each day he accompanied the patrons of the temple when they waited to see and then entered the abbot's quarters for interviews. So he was kind of a go-between between the wealthy patrons, the lay patrons, and the master, Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu always said to them, to the patrons, I guess, "It's like words without words, like a creeper held up by a tree, or like a vine wound around a tree." It's another translation. It's like words without words, like a vine wound around a tree. Once when Yuan Wu asked Da Wei a question, Da Wei started to answer when Yuan Wu cut him off by saying, "No, no." And then 6 months later, Da Wei asked Yuan Wu, "I've heard that previously you questioned Wuzu about this phrase." That is, the phrase, "It's like words without words, like a vine wound around a tree." "But I don't know what he answered." This is a Chinese indirect way of asking what the answer. "You asked him about this, but I don't know what he answered. Yuan Wu laughed, but did not reply to Da Wei's question. So Dawei said, at that time, you posed this question to everyone. Why not say it again now? So then Yuan Wu repeated the question. I said to Wu Zhu, what is the meaning of the phrase, it is words without words, like vines wound around a tree? Now this is still Yuan Wu talking. Wu Zhu answered me by saying, you can't trace it, it can't be drawn. I then asked him, when the tree has fallen down and the vine has withered, what then? Wu Zhu said, see what comes next. So this is all Yuan Wu relating to Da Wei, his exchange with this master Wu Zhu. And at these words, Da Wei was enlightened. He said, I understand. Yuan Wu then posed several probing questions to Da Wei, and Da Wei replied to each one without hesitation. Finally, Yuan Wu said, at last you know that I didn't deceive you. At last you know I didn't deceive you. But really know, really know. Until awakening, the student can't truly know that the teacher, what the teacher has been teaching, that all beings are equally endowed with this Buddha nature. Until that experience, we can't completely 100% know. The experience is the confirmation of the teaching. There's always some possibility of doubt creeping into the mind until awakening. One wants to believe that this very body is the body of Buddha. One wants to believe that form here is only emptiness, emptiness only form. One wants to believe that this world of phenomena is just one side of reality, and behind it, within it, is this world of emptiness, no self, world of no time, no space, no change, no karma, no right and wrong, no good and bad, no success or failure, no beginning or end, no birth or death. One wants to believe that. One does believe it, but believing is not the same as knowing through experience. And now that's the end of the long direct translation from the record of Da Wei. And now the editor, Andy Ferguson, picks up again. Before long, Yuan Wu shared his position of honor in the monastery with Da Wei. Da Wei's reputation spread widely. And when he was only 37 years old, the prime minister presented him with the ceremonial purple robe and the honorific title, Great Teacher Buddha Son. S-U-N, son. In the year 1137, Da Wei became abbot of such and such temple. This is where we get into the very risky politics in China at the time. One of Da Wei's students, a government official, became enmeshed in a political struggle. His opponent got the better of him and managed to execute that student, that government official, student of Da Wei's. Da Wei was caught up in the political fallout of this episode and was forced to flee with his monks to such and such a place. While there, he compiled the records of many ancient teachers, along with a large number of koans. The result was a 6-volume collection entitled The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. Hopefully that'll be translated into English someday. And then some 10 years later, Da Wei and his monks were forced by social unrest to move again, this time going quite far to the south. And there, plague and famine killed more than half of the 100 monks in Da Wei's group. Plague and famine killed more than half of the 100 monks in his group. It's hard for us to imagine that. Those of us living in this 21st century, industrialized Western country. What a different environment. What a different world it would be for us to be practicing, where half of us could be killed by plague and famine. We can certainly be grateful for the relative peace and order of our society, the prosperity, but who knows but that being so close, up close to death, starvation, and sickness, who knows but that that might have really fueled a deeper engagement with this practice, questioning that is lost on most of us. And then some 8 years later, social conditions improved. Da Wei was invited to move to a place and assume the abbacy there. In the years that followed, Da Wei emphasized that the goal of all practice is the realization of enlightenment. This seems so self-evident, that the goal of all practice is the realization of enlightenment. And yet, it is seldom emphasized anymore in contemporary American Zen. This is one of the little entanglements I had with the editor of Tricycle Magazine in this article I was writing, is he was concerned that by my mentioning about the need to awaken to one's true nature, it's setting up this binary situation where there'd be so many people who would feel, okay, that's not me. I'm somehow deficient. And I said, well, there's another response than, well, that's not me, which is to make it you, to find a way to do that. But their goal is to sell magazines. And so I worked with them on that. I'll just say, so what I said in the article, it's a short article, but kind of a thorny one for this and other reasons. What I said was that, that the three essentials of Buddhist practice, most of you have heard this before, but to review, the three essentials are meditation, morality, and wisdom. These are the three legs of a stool, and without all three, the stool will collapse. Well, the meditation is easy. For Westerners, everyone is happy to throw themselves into the meditation. The morality, that sounds kind of not as much fun for people who come to Zen. And then the third, wisdom, it's the original word is prajna, which means transcendental wisdom. In our school, from Harada Roshi, Yasutani Roshi, Kaplo Roshi, this is understood to be awakening, enlightenment. It really means the awakening to our innately enlightened wisdom, awakening to what we all have in common. So I said that, and then I acknowledged that until that experience, then we must find ways of using that innate wisdom, enlightened wisdom, prajna wisdom, through concentration and mindfulness. These are the two aspects of meditation, concentration and mindfulness. Use it not just on the cushion, but in daily life. And then we are exercising, we're working, we're manifesting our enlightened wisdom, even though we haven't awakened to it yet. Now, you don't have to read the article. Da Wei is known to have criticized silent illumination Zen. That's a phrase with quotation marks around it. Criticized silent illumination Zen, which held sway in the Soto school, or the Cao Dong school, as it was known in China. And the chief proponent of this teaching was Zen master Hong Zhi. I've read some of his words in Taisho. But it says here, and this is interesting, many scholars today point out that mutual respect and cordial relations existed between Da Wei and his supposed adversary. In fact, Hong Zhi requested that Da Wei take care of Hong Zhi's final affairs after his death. So you always wonder, you know, these records that come down to us, the history, how accurate it is, how much this supposed feud between Da Wei and Hong Zhi, how much of it is may have been kind of fabricated by the monks, their descendants, for who knows what reason. There's a lot of that in Japan historically, rivalry. But as it says here, scholars suggest that wasn't the case, that they had a lot of respect for one another. But it makes a good story to say that these two were bitter rivals or opponents. All right, that's let's go to the. That's enough for the biography, except for the outcome, the final. Yes. In the year Da Wei died, 1163, at the age of 75, it says, a falling star fell to the west of the temple with a terrifying flash. Da Wei soon became slightly ill. And then his disciples inquired about his health, and Da Wei exerted himself and said in a loud voice, tomorrow I'm setting off on a journey. Next morning, at 5 o'clock in the morning, he wrote his testimonial, and then he wrote a farewell letter to his friend, layman Ziyan. And then he was asked to compose a verse, a final, a death verse. This was the custom at the time. The masters became famous for their death verses. And I think probably under some pressure, Da Wei obliged them by writing the following. Birth is thus, death is thus. Verse or no verse, what's the fuss? And then he supposedly threw down the brush and passed away in a composed manner. Yeah, okay, there's more about after his death, but that's enough for now. Now we'll just start on some of his actual teaching, the material that we'll go to another source for, and that's the book already mentioned, Swampland Flowers, which subtitled The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Wei. This is translated by Christopher Cleary. First one in this, which we last read this material about 5 years ago. This is a letter to one of his disciples. He said, Da Wei says in the letter, Buddha said, if you want to know the realm of Buddhahood, you must make your mind as clear as empty space and leave false thinking and all grasping far behind, causing your mind to be unobstructed wherever it may turn. Now, let me point out a very important thing. Is when he says to make your mind as clear as empty space, this doesn't mean to stop all thought activity, which would mean basically to die, to be brain dead. That's never what it means when they say to make the mind empty. Clear as empty space means to be so free of the thought, this base level of thought activity, to be so uninvolved with it that it is as though the mind were absolutely empty. And so it is, in a way. This is Hakuin was making the same point in his chant in praise of Zazen that we just did, when he said, our thoughts now being no thought. I say this, I make this point, because too often I think people think that until they have absolutely no thought activity in the mind, and then they're out in left field. And that's not at all true. It just means you're not involved with those thoughts. You detach from them. You leave them alone. How do you do that? You all know how you do that. You become absolutely one with the breath or the koan, the shikantaza. We have something to go to. We have an alternative to dwelling in our thoughts. And it's by this thorough absorption in our particular practice that we can find ourselves in this realm of bright, clear space. Causing your mind to be unobstructed wherever it may turn. He goes on, the realm of Buddhahood is not some external world where there is a formal Buddha. It's the realm of the wisdom of an awakened sage. So it's not just a person who lived in India 1500 years ago. And we say this in the Hakuin chant from the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Not Buddhas. We don't need an S there. All beings are Buddha. All beings are enlightened in their true nature. Once you are determined that you want to know this realm, you do not need adornment, cultivation, or realization to attain it. Let's look at these three. You don't need adornment, of course. In 12th century China, this may, especially in the circles with Da Wei taught in, with the intelligentsia, the elite, adornment would have been a big thing. But he's just making that point. You don't need adornment. You don't need cultivation. Cultivation, I think, the translator here means you don't need practice, strictly speaking. Of course, Da Wei, all of his monks were practicing all the time, and probably he was too, even after his enlightenment. But it's not, strictly speaking, awakening is open to all of us, even without practice. And we know some accounts of people who knew nothing about practice and awakened on their own. So you don't need adornment, you don't need practice, cultivation, or realization to attain it. Realization? What do you mean? Don't need realization to attain it? No, because you are it. You are it. It's not a matter of attaining it. It's a matter of seeing that you don't need to attain it because you have always been it. Now here comes the caveat. You must clear away the stains of afflictions from alien sensations that have been on your mind since beginningless time, so that your mind is as broad and open as empty space, detached from all the clinging of the discriminating intellect, and your false, unreal, vain thoughts, too, are like empty space. Clear away the stains of afflictions that have been on your mind since beginningless time. Now we get into the work at hand. Our habit forces, above all our mental, emotional habit forces that have snarled into these afflictions that we all have. Detached from your false, unreal, vain thoughts. Vain, any thoughts of I, me, or my. Then this wondrous, effortless mind will be unimpeded wherever it goes. Wondrous, effortless mind. This is a state of great advanced, greatly advanced practice where the practice sort of runs on its own. We're not fighting our thoughts. We're not striving to get somewhere, but we have integrated it, harmonized with this Buddha mind, and then it is just as it is. This is another letter to another disciple. An ancient worthy had a saying, "To look for the ox, one must seek out its tracks. To practice the way, seek out mindlessness. Where the tracks are, so must the ox be." Now, this is, I think, is an unfortunate translation. The word mindlessness in English, this sounds like someone who is just not operating on all cylinders. No-mindedness. This is the word that I think is much better. No-mindedness is is this state of freedom where we're not impeded by this discriminating mind. We're not shackled with our thoughts. This is a state of no-mindedness, state of freedom. So again, the ox, of course, is this our own Buddha nature. To look for the ox, one must seek out its tracks. To practice the way, seek out no-mindedness. Where the tracks are, so must the ox be. This is him quoting an ancient worthy. Da Wei seems to be challenged with, in his talks with the names of his predecessors, and he often uses this phrase, an ancient worthy. I can sympathize. Now this is Da Wei. The path of no-mindedness is easy to seek out. So-called no-mindedness is not being inert and unknowing, like earth, wood, tile, or stone. It means that the mind is settled and imperturbable when in contact with situations and meeting circumstances, that it doesn't cling to anything, but is clear in all places, without hindrance or obstruction, without being stained, yet without dwelling in the stainlessness, that is, without getting attached to the notion of stainlessness or purity, viewing body and mind like dreams or illusions, yet without remaining in the perspective of dreams and illusions' empty nothingness. Only when one arrives at a realm like this can it be called true no-mindedness. No-mindedness is not something limited to the province of Zen practitioners, much less Zen masters. We see it on display in great athletic feats and great musical performances. To perform at such a level, one cannot have thoughts tying up the mind. I'll tell this story again. When a great tennis player Boris Becker he eventually went on to win 8 Grand Slam tournaments, one of the best of the 20th century. When Boris Becker was playing tennis and got into the zone, where he played something like 5 games. At such a level that even veteran fans couldn't believe their eyes. And afterward, after he'd won the match, a reporter asked him, "Boris, those 5 games, you couldn't miss everything. It was an incredible display. What were you thinking of at that time?" And he said, "Nothing. Nichts." We can all experience this state of freedom, freedom from thoughts, through hard work sustained over a long time. And then the challenge is to find a way to spend more and more time in that realm of freedom. We're not caught with indecisiveness, with comparing ourselves to others, judging our practice, either favorably or unfavorably, analyzing our practice, but instead just doing it, just mu. Who? What is it? Just just the breathing. Dawei continues, just get to the root. Don't worry about the branches. Well, we've talked about this before. It's seemed to be quite a common metaphor in Zen teaching. One way to understand this is just get to the source, get to the one mind, and don't worry about this and that, all of the differentiation of mind that will come. Get to the formlessness of things, of the formlessness of thoughts. Dawei says, emptying this mind is the root. Once you get the root, the fundamental, then all kinds of language and knowledge and all your daily activities as you respond to people and adapt to circumstances, these are the branches, through so many upsets and downfalls, whether joyous or angry, good or bad, favorable or adverse, these are all trivial matters, the branches. If you can be spontaneously aware and knowing as you are going along with circumstances, then there is neither lack nor excess. Again, no mindedness. We are really challenged with this in Sesshin when we find ourselves visited by one mind state after another, ups and downs, makyo, doubts, discouragement, then states of possibly euphoria and grandiosity. It's one that I used to go into in Sesshin. All of these states of mind are just passing. All right, now we'll stop and recite the four vows.